Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 12, 2018, the Carpool Justice Edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in D.C. in one part of New York, in one borough of New York, the borough of Brooklyn, Kings County, is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. I'm so glad you added the little Kings County. I can never remember all the counties. For my book, I've been having to like look at statistics that break the boroughs up by county. You know, Richmond County is another county.
Is Richmond County Staten Island?
Yes.
And then, not in Richmond County or the borough of Queens or Bronx, but in the borough of Manhattan, or maybe it's the borough of New York City, or the county of New York, is John Dickerson of CBS This Morning. Hello, John.
Hello.
Welcome back from vacation, also.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back.
On this week's GabFest, is there any chance Democrats can stop Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, and should they even bother to try? Then President Trump's strange campaign to sabotage NATO, even as he primps for his date with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. And then why on earth is the Trump administration trying to sabotage global health efforts that encourage breastfeeding? We will discuss that. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, we have a live show next week at the Keswick Theater in Glenside, PA, just outside of Philadelphia, on Wednesday, 7:30 p.m., July 18th. There's still tickets available. Go to slate.com/live to get tickets to join us. There is obviously going to be a boatload of news to discuss, and it's going to be really fun. So we would love to see you there. So please come to the Keswick Theater on Wednesday, July 18th. Go to slate.com/live to get tickets. On Monday night, President Trump nominated Brett Kavanaugh, 53-year-old judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, to succeed Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh, in one commentator's apt phrase, has been the Zelig of Republican lawyers. He was a clerk for Justice Kennedy himself. He was a Vince Foster suicide investigator. He was a Lewinsky prober. He was a Star Report author. He was a right-hand man to President George W. Bush. And for the past 12 years, he's been an extremely conservative Supreme Court justice in waiting in Washington, making rulings on all kinds of controversial issues. As we've also learned from very pleasant, agreeable pieces published in places like the Washington Post, New York Times, he's a really good carpooler. He likes to drive the carpool. He likes to coach his girls' basketball team. There's a lot of talk about that, about what a nice guy he is. And as somebody who's played basketball with him a few times, he's a nice guy. He's like a nice guy, good basketball player. But, Emily, you have a bee in your bonnet about this, which is, to use your phrase back at you, every time conservatives get nominated, some liberals come forward and make the case for them. This is happening with Kavanaugh. Should it be?
Here is what I was thinking about this morning. You know, there were these four finalists for this job, and some discussion of the differences among them. And the way in which they are different is not really a matter of votes. So if we're just talking about like a solid conservative majority, a solid conservative juggernaut, as Adam Liptak of The New York Times has been saying, then any of these folks are good for that job. And that's obviously the most important thing a Supreme Court justice does. But they differ in terms of their stories, their personal lives, which is going to matter a great deal in the next couple months for the confirmation hearings. And then they may differ in terms of the reasoning they use and the power of their intellect and their power to convince other justices and, you know, make big moves in the law by forming coalitions and getting all the other conservatives on board. And Kavanaugh's story is going to be tricky to some degree because of his role in the Starr investigation and the fact that he's touched like a million pieces of paper. So there's going to be some document fighting going on. And then also because of his Law Review articles in which he has talked about his doubts about the idea that a president can be criminally investigated. Now, this is like him kind of doing a mea culpa or a regret over his own role in the Starr investigation when obviously like he investigated President Clinton. So that's going to be an interesting part of this discussion. And then there's just the fact this is a very conservative judge with a very conservative record on the hotly contested issues, on abortion, on environmental laws, on voting rights, et cetera, et cetera. And so what I mean about liberals coming forward to make the case for him, and this happened in the New York Times, Akhil Amar, who's a colleague of mine at Yale Law School, and then there was also a press release with some liberal law professors at Yale Law School praising Kavanaugh. There's a kind of question about, like, why? And, you know, every time in my memory, since I've been covering the court, which I think is since John Roberts joined the court, this is always part of the pattern. And I think part of it is a kind of nostalgia for an apolitical court, a notion that there are criteria for judging Supreme Court nominees that are not partisan and not ideological. Wishful thinking about the position of these justices and of American law. You know, there are ways, and we've been talking about this, that Supreme Court justices do things all the time that are very kind of law-bound. They look at statutes, they agree on how to read them. There are not big ideological questions that come into play. But in the most important actions that Supreme Court justices take, politics and increasingly partisanship really do inform what they do. And it seems, to me at least, increasingly blind to pretend otherwise. So anyway, I wonder what you guys think about that.
Two questions about Kavanaugh. Is he himself particularly political? Because you could imagine a space for an argument where you say, sure, this is a conservative jurist, but they're going to call balls and strikes. And that's part of maybe what you were describing, Emily, as kind of the old fashioned way of looking at it. So there's the question. And we should note in that context that Mitch McConnell questioned Elena Kagan's impartiality as a former White House official when she was up for the court. So this has been a question of whether candidates themselves are specifically political relative to whatever the standard is for normal Supreme Court justices. Then there's the larger context, which bleeds into basically all the coverage of politics these days right now, which is that we are in a special time with respect to the Supreme Court. We do have the move by Mitch McConnell to block Merrick Garland's even coming up for a hearing, which is unprecedented, particularly with respect, and I don't need to go back into Abe Fortas, but particularly with respect to the most analogous case where you had a Democratic president going out of office, working with a Republican leader to actually put somebody on the court at a later period in an election year. So what some liberals are saying is, wait a minute, in a world where the majority leader of the Senate can block a guy from even being heard, let's dispense with this kind of old-fashioned notion of looking at these judges as if they're not in a political context.
So I would say, first of all, that I would be so happy if this metaphor of balls and strikes and umpires could be just like dead on arrival forever. And the reason I say that, it has zero meaning. Like, is Brett Kavanaugh fair in the sense that he will judge the facts before him? Sure. So all of them are. But I think what we mean by that merely is we have no evidence of like outright corruption, right? You know, if anyone thinks that Brett Kavanaugh is going to get on the Supreme Court and like suddenly change his mind about abortion rights after having dissented, you know, last year in a case in which the issue was an undocumented teenager who was in government custody, she said she wanted an abortion. The Trump administration didn't want to facilitate that. Kavanaugh dissented from the ruling that allowed her to get the procedure. And he, you know, used this sort of He's very smart and also savvy. And so he didn't go as far as one of his colleagues in like denouncing Roe for no particular reason, because it wouldn't have had any legal utility. But he talked about what she was asking for as some brand new right to abortion on demand. That's like a kind of linguistic flair that you use to, you know, tell abortion opponents that you're on their side. I don't know what it would mean for him to have an open mind about that. He has prior expressed views. Judges tend to have prior views that they bring to their work. And there are cases that come before the Supreme Court that matter deeply to American society, in which there is more than one possible answer. And so they pick the answer that lines up with their ideological preferences.
But so, Emily, from what I can see, your objection to Kavanaugh comes down to an objection to any possible person that a Republican president would nominate, which is that any possible person a Republican president would nominate would have these criteria. And the fact that Garland was so viciously and savvily blocked by McConnell means that the process, or was just further evidence that this process is wholly compromised, and therefore Democrats shouldn't go along with it. But it doesn't sound like you think there's any, if Kavanaugh doesn't meet your criteria for a potential justice that Democrats could say nice things about, then it sounds like probably nobody would.
Well, probably no one who President Trump would pick. But I think the context, the second point John made, at least to me, is crucial because we're in this world still of a different composition of the Supreme Court because of what happened with Merrick Garland. And the other thing that concerns me is that, and we already were in this world in the last year or so with Kennedy, but we are increasingly going, and even beyond the last year with Kennedy, we are going to continue to have a court in which there are four moderate liberals appointed by Democratic presidents and four real conservatives nominated by Republican presidents. And that, we have not had that for at least the last half century. There was crossover. There was crossover because for the most part, Republicans were kind of fumbling and not producing reliably conservative justices all the time, right? I'm talking about David Souter, John Paul Stevens, Sandra Day O'Connor, and Kennedy himself in a few particular ways. We are losing that in the same way that in Congress we have lost bipartisan crossover. And that polarization is both producing more extreme Supreme Court picks and also making Congress less functional as a branch that does its job. And so then you have this sort of vacant a power vacuum that the Supreme Court kind of steps into, which is why, sorry, I hope this isn't too circuitous, one of the key questions about Kavanaugh that people like Cass Sunstein have been asking and Jack Goldsmith, who's a conservative Harvard Law professor, is hopeful about this. One big question is about this idea of judicial restraint. So this is different from like the conservative to liberal axis. This is how much do you believe the judges should step in and solve problems? And, you know, Jack Goldsmith, maybe Cass Sunstein are hopeful that John Roberts is a minimalist, a judicial restraint person, and that Kavanaugh will be as well. I think it's totally unclear that those things are true, but that will be a really big question coming forward.
Well, but Emily, look, I think that this calcified and concrete conservative majority on the Supreme Court will have baleful effects for all kinds of reasons, which I'll get into in a second. But it's also conservatives are not wrong when they point out that the Supreme Court was relatively quite liberal a long time in the late 20th century.
And that, no, that's just a false premise.
It's not a
but
false
continue.
Premise.
In the 1960s, it was true. The
right.
Warren
the
Court,
Warren
that
court
is absolutely
liberal,
true.
Right?
Yeah. Beyond yeah. that, yes. you're just...
That's I, what he's
just,
talking about. Yeah. He's just... Yeah, but continue there's, on. There's but an, he, picked the wrong, a, he picked the wrong time, yeah, but he's talking a, about
1960s.
The same thing.
All right. And then it was, sort of moderate left for a while. And then it's become, in the past 25
on
years,
some
very
issues.
Conservative.
I mean, not on corporate power and, corporations versus workers, for example. Keep going. It's been extremely pro-corporate for decades.
Yeah, for the past 30 years, it's been extremely pro-corporate, for sure. But this is why there was a conservative project to go after the court, was the sense that, wow, the court has really gone, and not just the Supreme Court, but the lower courts have become much more liberal than we conservatives can tolerate, and actually more liberal than the people are. Now we have a court that is wildly more conservative than the people are. I thought there was a wonderful piece by John Casty, The New Yorker, saying what's so demoralizing about the court is the court does not represent any actual popular desire for, as he says, for bans on abortions, restrictions on collective bargaining, roadblocks to legal claims against big companies, or the purging from the electoral rolls of voters who skip a couple of elections. There isn't actually popular demand for any
That's
of
right.
the things that this Supreme Court is going to uphold or has indicated it's going to uphold. And so now not only is Congress itself wildly more conservative than the voters who vote for it, the president is wildly more conservative than the voters who voted for him and in fact was not elected by a majority of the voters.
Well,
and the Supreme Court is now so a third branch of government is going to have the same quality, and that's a recipe for a non-democratic and non-representative government system.
Let me give my own version of the history that you are glossing over, which you may disagree with. I mean, I think what happened in the 60s and the 70s was that conservatives picked up a few key issues on which they thought the court was wildly liberal. So there's the law and order complaints from Richard Nixon because of the Warren Court precedents expanding the rights of criminal defendants. There's Roe versus Wade. Not immediately. Let's remember that Roe was 7-2 by the Berger Court. But by the late 70s, obviously that has become a big wedge issue. And then I would say school prayer is also something that really incensed conservatives and got them going. There's all this other stuff the court does that matters so much. Voting rights, you know, things like campaign finance, the rights of workers versus corporations. And I don't think the court has been out of step toward the left on those issues. But it is absolutely true that conservatives have succeeded much more than liberals in making the court a voting issue. And so, yeah, now we're where you just said. And I guess my big question is whether the court will figure out a way to steer a path that is very conservative, but not so out of step that the country like revolts in some way. So like that's door number one, is like John Roberts finds a path through this and the kind of institutional legitimacy of the court is preserved and the court does some things that are conservative, but it's like okay in the end because Roberts emerges as more of a centrist figure. I don't personally hold out a lot of hope for this, but it's possible. And it goes with this judicial restraint idea. Door number two is a court that really, really goes to the right, but in a way that puts it at odds not only with the American public, but eventually with Congress and the presidency. And then you get to a scenario that's like 1937. Barry Friedman, a NYU law professor who wrote a book all about the court and public opinion, has been prophesying this, the idea of like the FDR court packing scheme, which was bad for him as a president, bad for the court backed down. Right. So it's a crisis. It's a constitutional crisis even, but it gets resolved through the political system. Door number three is like a slow erosion of rights, especially voting rights and like fair and accessible elections, in a way that while the court is frustrating popular will, the public loses its way to elect Democrats effectively. Like the court is really entrenching Republican partisan power. And that's scary. Like, I don't know where that ends. I was talking to Mark Tushnet, another really interesting con law professor, about this the other day. And he was like, well, that's the 1960s. But you could also argue that that's the 1850s. So anyway.
So the court packing thing confuses me, though, because it was the court knocking down FDR either legislation or administrative actions that caused him to want to pack the court so he could stop getting the things he wanted to do undone. Were you referring to the court that was undoing all the stuff he wanted to do, or
yeah,
the court, or okay,
yeah? So like, imagine that imagine a world in which there's a Democratic Congress and president and they pass Medicare for all. And the court says that's unconstitutional. That's, goes too far in terms of congressional authority. There's no power in the Commerce Clause to do this. That's what I mean.
John, I want to ask you a question about a subject that is very near and dear to your heart, which is the ability of people to change their mind. One of the big Kavanaugh issues is his view on executive power, and his view in particular on whether a president should be distracted or paralyzed by a investigation of possible wrongdoing by the president. And he, of course, rose to prominence, Kavanaugh, as part of Ken Starr's team of prosecutors and investigators who did quite a lot to waylay and undermine the Clinton presidency with an investigation of President Clinton's sexual misbehavior and potential perjury. As then he moved on to the White House, where he worked on President George W. Bush's staff through 9/11 and through the rise of the Homeland Security concerns and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he says he underwent a change of heart. And his change of heart leads him to believe that the president should be very leery of allowing prosecutors to investigate the president for criminal or civil wrongdoing in office. Mm-hmm. First of all, do you think this is an important issue that we really need to get to the bottom of in terms of who he's going to be as a justice, or is it sort of a sideshow? And two, do you think it's a credible change of heart?
Well, it's so interesting. I think they're related, because Akhil Amar, in his case that he makes for Kavanaugh, I couldn't tell in reading the New York Times piece by Akhil Amar whether he was slightly concerned trolling or whether he meant it all 100% straight up as he wrote it. Because basically he says, well, Kavanaugh's change of heart about how he carried out the his duties for Starr and what he thinks now represent just exactly what you want in judges, which is their ability to change their mind and have adaptive thinking as they mature and as they're faced with different kinds of facts. I think a lot of liberals think he just changed his views based on where he was sitting. I mean, he just, you know, so when it was in his interest to go after a Democratic president, he held one view. And then when he was protecting the executive power of another, of a Republican president, he changed his mind. So I don't know. I'm not in his heart. It obviously matters to those people who think that he was picked. And I don't know if that there's any evidence for this, but that he was picked because the president thinks one day his issues might appear before the court, and this is a more sympathetic voice based on what he's written before. He's not the only one who has argued that a president shouldn't be pinned down by civil and criminal action outside of the impeachment process. Bill Clinton's lawyers certainly argued that. Basically,
and
any
they
lawyer
lost on the civil front.
Right. But my point is that if you're trying to identify where this strain of thinking comes,
yes, 100%.
It comes from both Democratic and Republican presidents.
I mean, I guess what I keep thinking about with this is like a bad movie. Like, it's not even a movie. It's like a bad television show that a president who's under investigation and then there's, you know, a big separation of powers question. Can he be subpoenaed? Let's just start with that. Can Mueller make him sit down and ask questions? The deciding vote potentially for that question is going to be someone who the president has chosen, who has on the record this particular public change
but
of heart.
Kavanaugh made it very clear in that Law Review article, which I have not read, but just read people saying this. So I assume that when they say he made it very clear, he did, that Congress would have to pass a law to protect the president from this kind of investigation. So he doesn't...
I don't know about that. No, he said that would be his preference, that if the best way to address this would be for Congress to provide immunity. He didn't say that the court wouldn't step in if Congress doesn't.
But it's implicit in that. My belief is that there is no such protection exists now, that the Constitution provides no protection.
I mean, I think you really can read those articles both ways, and people are reading into them what they want to read. And also, obviously, he's not bound by exactly what he said.
That's number one. Number two... Well, in the case of an indictment, this is a bigger issue. But in the case of a subpoena, I can't imagine. Like, John Roberts does not want to have a court which divides 5-4 on partisan grounds over a subpoena.
No, he doesn't.
He's going to make sure he gets, you know, 8 votes in one direction or another on that. And so, or finds a compromise so that they don't have to rule at all.
Maybe. We'll see. It'll be
And Mueller
really
is not
going
to indict. Mueller's
happens.
Not going to indict the president. He's not going to do it. He doesn't believe he can. He's not going to do it. He'd have to be. It would cause such a crisis that it's so unlikely to happen. And so I don't think Kavanaugh is going to have to.
The indictment part.
Will not have to rule on that.
But here's the thing that also bothers me, though. Like, what if you're right about all of that? And what if, because Mueller doesn't want to prompt a potentially, you know, devastating clash, he doesn't subpoena Trump? In other words, the elevation of Kavanaugh just fends off what otherwise would have been a pretty clearly permissible thing to do. Like, when you go back and you look at the opinions about Clinton and Nixon, in which I think there were either 8 or I think 9 votes that suggest, right, we're going back to the Nixon tapes. It's not a subpoena of the president, but you go back and you read those Supreme Court opinions, it looks to me like Mueller can make Trump sit down and ask questions. What if Mueller decides not to push it because of the scenario, like because of where we are with this particular Supreme Court? That in itself is a deep loss, I would say, or at least like a problem. If other institutions start to behave strangely because they are reacting to what is itself like looks not good, that's bad.
I feel like you're a little deep and hypothetical, but all right. We've been talking about this a while. There are two quick things I want to get to before we wrap this. For you, John, one is, why, given what Emily said at the beginning, which is that any conservative justice is basically going to end up ruling the same way, why does Trump bother to name yet another middle-aged white guy from Yale? Like, that's number one. And number two is, do you see any political danger to Kavanaugh, or does it feel like the votes are pretty locked?
Well, on the first, why not? And from the Trump looking at this, particularly from the Trump perspective, why not nominate another white male? I think, I mean, he has a different view of these kinds of things, I think. Secondly, I think having Amy Comey Barrett in the wings is a sort of elect me one more time, and then we really, are going to, you know, because he's got a chance at one or two more Supreme Court seats if he wins, if he has an 8-year term or 8-year presidency, I should say.
Totally agree with that analysis.
And then, by the way, on the court, I don't know what you guys think. We had Chuck Schumer on the show this week, and you know, he basically sounded like he was aiming right for Collins and Murkowski, arguing that you know, this is that Kavanaugh is the product of a selection process determined to undo Roe. So then I said, okay, well, if he's determined to undo Roe and the Affordable Care Act, then would it be a betrayal of the party for any Democrat to vote for him? And he ducked it like it was a boulder rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue.
For the sake of the and red Joe state Manchin, Democratic senators, right?
For this, exactly. And so for the sake of the red state Democrats who are going to be under a lot of pressure, by the way, from lots of Democratic constituent groups, Joe Manchin has already pretty much looks like, unless something crazy comes up, he's going to vote for him. And you had the case, by the way, you had the precedent. Nine Republicans, I think, voted for Sotomayor. I can't remember the numbers, but I think it's 9-6 for Sotomayor and Kagan in terms of Republicans voting for the nominee of a Democratic president. So I don't know if you're going to have Democrats crossing over unless there's some black swan event, which is to say something in his background that's really highly unexpected.
And didn't Gorsuch get 54 votes? So there were like 3 Democrats who voted for Gorsuch.
Yeah, I think Heitkamp. Manchin,
yeah, I think
somebody else.
Donnelly maybe.
And Donnelly maybe. I what you get into in a case like that is if the dam has broken, if there's no way it's not going
right.
to, if there's no
you
way to block him, you'll get a lot. Yeah. So in fact, Kavanaugh could get. You could imagine a situation in which Kavanaugh gets more votes than Gorsuch,
yeah.
Even though, as Emily has pointed out, the stakes are so much higher.
All right, Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts. And this week, we're going to talk about the strange scandal engulfing House Republican Jim Jordan and the abuse of wrestlers at Ohio State University when he was assistant wrestling coach there. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member. $35 for your first year. That's a bargain. And you get to hear our Slate Plus bonus discussions. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu. President Trump has wrapped up his short visit to the NATO summit in Brussels. He's now in the UK and then will be heading to the party he really wants to go to, a one-on-one summit with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. The president spent the lead up to the NATO summit trashing the alliance, and he continued much the same while he was in Brussels. He declared that Germany was totally controlled by Russia. He lobbied and insisted that NATO members bump up their defense spending to 4% of GDP, which even the U.S. is not at 4% of GDP. And he generally made clear his scorn for the partnership, ultimately throwing in a few kind words saying, of course, he supports it. This tension with NATO comes as the president has rolled out tariffs on European products. He's withdrawn, of course, from the Paris Climate Agreement, whacked Europe for not supporting our Iran deal cancellation. And so on and so on and so on and so on. So, John, why has the president been so derisive towards our closest allies and towards our greatest military alliance? What does he get out of that?
He doesn't believe necessarily in the alliance, although, as you say, on Thursday, he was much more, for somebody who said that NATO was obsolete and asked in a tweet this week whether why NATO has to exist at all, he said several times that it was important and necessary for the United States. So I think another possible theory is this is some combination of his just irritation with the Europeans, and he wants them to pay more money. They've promised to spend 2% by 2024. It seems quite clear that he has in fact gotten them to increase in a way that administrations going back to the 70s who've asked them to to the NATO members to pay a greater share of their defense. He seems to have been more successful. So in that case, then there were a lot of people who were arguing he should just go and take a victory lap at the beginning.
What's your evidence for that, John?
The increase in spending of those countries who have said for a long time, yes, yes, we're going to pay. But they would say, yes, yes, we're going to pay to the Obama administration. And then the president would complain about the free riders in Europe. And so when you go from, yes, yes, I'm going to pay to immediately going to the president with demonstrations of how much you're paid and are paying, that changes the tenor of it is now front of mind with a lot of these countries, even if it's to deal with the unpredictable and bombastic and irritating American president. They are thinking about it much more today, to the extent that this is an objective that's been shared by Republican and Democratic administrations for years, and making commitments more now than they were under the previous administration.
Emily, so it's pretty clear from Trump's body language, the way he's talked about the two summits that he's going to be, the two primary summits he's attending, the NATO and then his Putin summit, that there's one he's excited about and one he was not. And he really does seem to be pretty eager to get to his meeting with Putin. What's the danger of that summit? Or is it a huge opportunity? Is it a chance to reset, to have a reset with Russia?
I see two risks. I mean, the first is that Trump does something like tell Russia it's like super cool that they invaded Crimea. Don't worry about it. Which seems like less of a risk right now, given the NATO statement he just signed. But I mean, who knows? This is an unpredictable, self-contradictory person. And the second risk is embracing Putin in a way that sends a message that all the election meddling he's doing in our elections, in Brexit, etc., is fine. Like, doesn't matter that, you know, not only are we giving countries a pass on human rights violations, but also on this like core question of meddling in democracy. Now, look, Russia's not the only country that meddles in elections. The United States has a history of doing that too. But that doesn't make it a good idea to encourage Russia when we know that they have every reason to have their sights trained on our election. And then there's just this weird undercurrent, which is like maybe Trump thinks it's totally fine for Putin to mess around in our election as long as Putin is benefiting Trump, you know, and that is all against this backdrop of these larger continual questions about Trump's relationship with Russia over time. And I wonder what you both thought about an article Jonathan Chait wrote, or at least published this week, kind of laying out a 30-year relationship between Russia and Trump. It has a lot of different moving parts to it. And I was especially struck by a response to that article by Tom Nichols, who's like an incredibly astute and experienced reporter on U.S.-Russia relations. And he was like, look, you know, maybe Chait doesn't have everything right along the way, but when you look at this, there's no way not to conclude there's evidence that Russia has damaging information on the president. I found that to be quite a hair-raising and eyebrow-raising statement. What did you guys think about it?
Yeah, I thought the Nichols piece was very persuasive in arguing that Chait outlines an extraordinary amount of contact between Trump and Russia dating 30 years, of huge variety of relationships, of contacts, of interactions, which far outstrip what I think most people think exist, and far outstrip what you think is reasonable for any particular American to have with an adversary. A lot of it is really suspicious. It's really hard to imagine that there was a long game which involved them getting Trump elected president. I'm sure it was that here's this bombastic, egomaniacal, corrupt businessman who's a public figure in America. He's an opportunity. Let's use him as an opportunity, and who knows what'll come with it. And it turned out it was just a bet that paid off 100, 1,000-fold for them. Not because I think he's an actual spy or that he's actually controlled by Russia, but just that there is this, you know, slow manipulation, getting him to sympathize with their interests, to get him economically tied in with Russians, to just make him listen to them, to hire people like Paul Manafort, that that causes him to act in ways that really benefit their interests. And it is very clear that the country that has benefited most from the Trump presidency is Russia, which has had this extraordinary rise to prominence. I mean, when you think about it, it's a country which has a GDP that's half the size of California. It's a GDP that's smaller than Germany's. And Trump treats Putin like, you know, they're the two leaders of the world. And yep. Putin is presides over an economically degraded, environmentally degraded, you know, dying country. And yet he's because of all this manipulation, he has brought himself back to power, and he's massively weakened Europe. And it's a very, very depressing. John, what did you think of that piece?
What he's done is put all of the material even in one place. And as Nichols writes, it's impossible to see the total picture and reach the conclusion that there's an innocent explanation behind it all. Even if you think that Jonathan Chait has put his thumb on the scale in several areas, and I think there is a way in which he sort of is credulous about basically anything that's said about Trump. Okay, let's take away 20% of what he puts on his list, or 30. Still, it's a mountain of stuff. And it just suggests a closeness or an empathy or a connection to Russia that's curious for an American president at a time when the president has, you know, an opposite kind of feeling about America's traditional allies. I mean, just leaving aside for whether there's criminality involved, it's just, is this the national security posture America wants? It doesn't even seem to be the national security posture that the administration wants. If you listen to Kay Bailey Hutchinson, the president's NATO ambassador on Face the Nation on Sunday, when asked about Russia, she went through a long litany of what did she call it? Malign behavior. I mean, point by point by point by point. It was everything from poisoning, a former Russian spy in Great Britain, which has now killed another person, to Crimea, to what it's doing in, well, it's adventurism all over the world. And then I'm not even sure she included meddling in the U.S. elections, which, by the way, a senior U.S. official says they are getting daily intelligence reports right now about actions that the Russians are taking to try to destabilize the American system. So you have to add that to any accounting you have about the closeness between the relationship between the president is then what you really want, what an American president should be doing in terms of what's in America's national security interest. I mean, there is a disconnect between the sanctions that are still on Russia, some of them because Congress forced them. But the U.S. is still arming Ukraine and has shut, you know, Russian consulates and things like that. So there are things being taken in other parts of the administration separate and apart from what the president says that are anti-Russia. Also, here's what's weird. Putin hates NATO, right? So in one hand, president is on Wednesday, he's beating up the Germans, calling them hypocrites, destabilizing NATO, which is all something Putin would love. But when he talks about getting those NATO countries to spend more on their own defense, that's not something NATO that Putin necessarily wants. So that's another thing here that's a bit of a puzzler.
It makes me so depressed. The NATO alliance and the recovery of Europe after World War II have caused the rise of the two richest continents the world has ever seen. North America and Europe, Western Europe, have become unimaginably wealthy and peaceful and cooperative. And
Europe does a pretty good job of taking care of the people who live there, too.
And Europe does a pretty good job taking care of people who live there, and it's now extended to countries in Eastern Europe that had been in under the Soviet bloc. And it is so incredibly depressing to me to watch us, because of the stupidity of our president, to degrade that alliance, to degrade the value. Of course, all these things, you know, they need to be balanced. Not everything that Europeans want to do is great, and not every policy they pursue is great, and certainly they've gotten huge benefit from being under the American military umbrella, where we have in fact made enormous investments that have allowed them not to invest in their own military. But to think that this has not been anything other than an enormous benefit for all the 800 million odd people who live on both continents is crazy, and it's depressing.
Here's the most benign argument I've heard from somebody who's not particularly a defender of the president's. In fact, not at all. But the argument is basically this. Look, at the military level, which is where NATO matters, James Mattis is a guy who is like reared in the American tradition of the NATO alliance. Like, it's in his bones. And he is maintaining and answering requests from NATO countries to work with, coordinate with, and keep the alliance not just existent, but make it even stronger. So that's what's really happening in terms of the NATO alliance. Because it's a military alliance, I think there are all kinds of other benefits as well, obviously, in terms of maintaining a certain set of values, in terms of the lots of other reasons that you want countries to be aligned. But where it really matters, the U.S. military to military operations are strong, and that the president's bombast is really actually can mostly be ignored. And to the extent that it helps get the other countries to pick up their spending on their military, then that's good for the U.S.
The most amazing thing I learned in the course of this reading is that for the last 22 years, Belgium and the Netherlands have literally shared a navy. It's two separate countries, and they have
good
one
for them.
Navy.
Who needs everybody doesn't
it's
need
so
to have
cute.
Their own navy?
Yeah, it's fine. Great seafaring nation.
I mean, I guess, John, my question, I like your benign explanation. And like, if they pay their bills or pay more for their defense and we get to spend less, I guess, like, good. But I wonder about whether you can ignore the president's bombast if it has implications for how Putin in particular
sure.
behaves. Like, if it's
yeah.
an invitation for Putin to test NATO and try to further weaken it, whether that's election meddling or it takes a different form,
yeah.
then it seems like whatever, you know, coalition yeah. building, like solid wall, you know, alliance stuff Mattis is doing, it could be overwhelmed by something that hasn't happened yet, like by facts on
yeah.
the ground that we can't quite foresee.
Right. The downside is that countries make their decisions based on predictable arrangements. And one of the beauties and benefits of NATO is that this is a solid, stable, predictable thing that has ensured peace in Europe for the last 70 years. You need stability because the events are unpredictable enough. So why come in there, rattle this thing, cause a meeting that should be focused on other security concerns? Why turn it into basically a sideshow only for the president? When you create instability, other countries make their own bets. And that means not only members of NATO, but as you say, Russia. So sure, the alliance might be there in the end to counter Russia. But why give Russia an invitation by suggesting the alliance is weaker because of the actions of an American president?
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Here is a fight I did not expect to read about. Earlier this year, in the spring, the United States bullied, lobbied, and harangued other nations in an attempt to water down a statement by the World Health Assembly, which is a sort of the governing body of the World Health Organization, a statement by them promoting breastfeeding. Ecuador had planned to introduce this statement, this statement of goodwill, of policy, and something. I mean, it doesn't have the force of law, but it's the force of sort of recommendation to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding. The statement condemned certain kinds of marketing practice of certain foods towards mothers and with babies. United States officials in the State Department and HHS threatened Ecuador with trade sanctions and the loss of military assistance if it introduced the resolution. And U.S. sort of went around trying to talk people out of supporting this resolution. Eventually, Russia went ahead and introduced the resolution more or less as it was written, and it passed. Russia was not threatened, apparently. So, Emily, what to make of this? I mean, I have so many thoughts about it.
What to make of this? Well, I mean, yeah, there are various things that are interesting. I guess, though, what seems overarching here is that the companies that make formula wanted the United States to water down or block this resolution. And so that was what the United States tried to do. And, there's an important distinction here between breastfeeding in the United States, and I don't know, maybe Europe, and breastfeeding in the rest of the world, especially places where water is not clean. So in the United States, and especially in, you know, wealthy blue cities, there has been maybe like too much pressure to breastfeed on women. And what I mean about that is that if you have trouble breastfeeding and you don't breastfeed exclusively for like a year, people judge you, or at least you might feel judged. And I think that is a problem. Like, that is a kind of level of zealotry that has gone too far. And Hannah, your dear wife, has written about this more probably than anyone. So you know a lot about this, maybe. I hope. And, you know, I say this, like, I loved breastfeeding. I completely recommend it if it works for you. I think it's like one of the most powerful experiences of my life as a mother. I totally am on board for it. But I don't think that women should be made to feel like failures if it's not working. And if you have clean water and other good nutrition, then the health benefits of breastfeeding are not so great that we should be like beating people up over it. However, in the developing world where water is not clean and nutrition is not good, it is a real problem when women feel like they need to spend money on formula instead of breastfeeding. I mean, there's a study from The Lancet from 2016 showing that, you know, we would save umpteen dollars, but also save, I think, 800,000 lives if
a year,
women,
which I kind of don't
year,
believe
if breastfeeding.
Anyway,
it was high. I also was a little bit wanted the sort of I wanted Hannah actually to write about that study and tell me what to think. But in any case, it seems clear that there are important health benefits internationally. And also, of course, there's this irony that like conservatives who believe in family values, one would imagine would promote breastfeeding as like a thing that they would want women to do. And so the idea that the corporate profit part of the equation trumps, forgive me for the metaphor, those pro-family baby health concerns, it seems upsetting.
It's weird. We should go ahead, John.
Note that the administration denies it did any of this, but...
Yeah, you should say that out loud.
I'm sure none of it happened.
Yeah, you should say it louder. They do deny it.
Well, they deny it, and there are two important things to say that they deny. They deny that the threats were made to Ecuador, and there was also some reporting, was this in the Times piece, that they even threatened the World Health Organization.
By saying they were going to pull some funding.
By saying they were going to pull funding, yeah. So,
did it matter to you that those denials were from some anonymous government official? I was really, yeah. Like,
well,
it seemed,
I mean,
really
it,
weird
this
to me that nobody in the Department of Health and Human Services could come forward with their name and explain. Anyway, sorry.
Right. Well, it was anonymous source to anonymous source, right? I mean, you have, because I think the Ecuadorian stuff is all anonymous as well.
Yeah, but it just seems like if someone from the United States government wants to say, like, here's our position, it, like, what's the big, anyway, sorry.
Especially since they said, because in the response they were saying, how dare you claim that we weren't, I mean, was there anything in this idea that was there a substantive argument that just could have gotten muddled in the way these things get discussed, like in terms of breastfeeding after a certain age or any context to this that?
I mean, maybe. I just wasn't sure what was true or not. Like, I never read anything that had the actual full wording of the resolution in its initial form. So it was really hard for me to tell whether the resolution went too far in the way that Molly Hemingway for The Federalist was claiming. Did you have a way of sorting that out?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I mean, the idea that the U.S. threatened Ecuador was all based on anonymous sources. So that should make us all skeptical. But then the pushback against that wasn't very strong.
No.
You know, in other words, the denials were, as you said, not on the record. You know,
it does seem clear that Ecuador was supposed to introduce something and didn't, and Russia ended up introducing it. But a Russian official speaking anonymously, but as a Russian official, said, you know, look, we're not being like heroes here. We just didn't. Just seems wrong for these countries to get bullied. So at least there's there are multiple sources saying something fishy happened. Yeah. And there's no, I can't imagine what why Ecuador would withdraw it if they didn't feel right. there was some threat. It's not.
Right, right.
No, and it's
the
a
other
good point.
Thing
the
that
Times...
I found dismaying was that this was part of the Time story, I think, that the United States has also been trying to prevent countries from banning advertising targeting kids from soda companies or attack, like the right. whole notion that these sugary sweet drinks are also a health risk, which we have mounting scientific evidence for, that America's also going around throwing around its weight on behalf of the soda companies internationally in these health forums. And that I found like just as disturbing.
You know, as I was talking to Han about this morning, she was saying, in some circumstances, you can make a case that formula is as important as the pill. Formula is this enormous liberator of women and has right. had huge economic benefits, in especially, as you point out, Emily, in places with clean water and good nutrition, where it's safe, it's relatively safe to feed a baby formula. And it's the formula companies are, in many ways, they're doing something that's highly noble and good. And it can be true that it is both a positive good and yet a worse option. And it can be true that it is both a positive good and yet also needs to be regulated and monitored, and the way it is marketed needs to be controlled. It seems to me like this, that it's a classic case of the Cass Sunstein like nudge, that this is a case where significant sort of regulation and monitoring and encouragement of the right sort is necessary, but you do want that. You do want formula to be available, and for many women who we all know, the ability to feed their child with formula has allowed them, you know, peace of mind. It's allowed them to hold jobs that they otherwise might have lost. It's given them freedom. It's given them, and it's given their baby a chance to feed after health difficulties. So it's not a simple question.
Right. I mean, I think the place-specific analysis is so crucial here, right? Like, if you're in nudge land, the answer of how you would want to create the regime that leads to, like, the optimal amount of breastfeeding, but also, like, the possibility of formula feeding for people who need to go back to work and who don't have the luxury of being able to pump, or it just doesn't work out for them. The nudge answer in the United States is different than right. the nudge sure. answer in a developing yep. country. Right. Like, really, yeah. really different. And I right. sometimes feel like we lose sight of that as American women. We're thinking about our own circumstances too much in this conversation.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Let's go to cocktail chatter when you're having a, I'm not sure. I don't think there are cocktails made from breast milk. That would be there's probably some weird subculture where people do that. I don't really want to know about that. So,
and yeah, you brought it up and now
we all
have to think
about
it.
I'd like to try
it.
To connect
Great.
My cocktail chatter introduction to a previous discussion. And so what we're talking about, breast milk, you could make a, make a white Russian with Infamil. Anyway, when you're having your Similac white Russian, on your porch, John Dickerson, what are you going to be chattering about?
Well, I don't know that this will be what I will chatter about, but anyway, that I was listening.
That's the whole premise, John Dickerson.
I know. I realized I was being incredibly
hard all of a sudden.
That was so weird. I was being incredibly fastidious to the conceit, which is a pretty flimsy one in the first place. Anyway, I apologize. But that was like a
We're
super.
We're going to follow you around with the camera all weekend. And if you have a drink and you don't talk about whatever you say
I suddenly got hyper literal. That was very weird. I'm so sorry. Anyway. So I was reading about Laura Ingalls Wilder because of her the recent removal of her name from a prize because of her writings and her beliefs. And anyway, this has nothing to do with
absurd.
That.
Absurd. Anyway,
so
we don't
anyway,
need to discuss.
One of the things I learned in reading about her was about her time in the American frontier, and I started to and that she lived through some of the most, the biggest and most extraordinary locust hordes. And I thought, like, well, how bad could the locust hordes be? I mean, I know obviously they're in the Bible.
Oh, my God. You remember the scene from the book?
Yes.
They can be really bad.
I know. Well, I had not come across that scene. And then I started to look. I mean, it's amazing.
On the Banks of Plum Creek? Is that the right book?
So,
oh, my God. I'll never forget that.
On the Banks of Plum Creek. Very well done. Yes. They're being attached to her clothes. But I mean,
they eat all the crops. It forces them to move.
It's totally devastating.
It
destroys
to the family,
them.
To be outdone by the long winter. Go ahead.
But so they would throw rugs over their gardens to try to protect them, and the locusts would just eat through the rugs and then get the garden. They would take huge like swaths of tar and spread it to smear it on the, and just hopefully that the locusts would get stuck in it. I mean, it was just these like desperate attempts, firing shotguns into the sky. And in 1875, the species formed the largest recorded swarm in the history of humankind, 1,800 miles long and 110 miles wide, which equals the combined area of Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Vermont. They were a weather system. And this, of course, destroyed thousands of farms and families, which she records and on the banks of Plum Creek. Anyway, and then like 20 years later, after that massive swarm in 1875, they basically vanished. And the last collection of alive Rocky Mountain locust was made 100 years ago in 1902. So that's what I know.
Good. All right. Emily, what is your cocktail chatter?
All right. I'm returning to the Supreme Court, so forgive me, but this is for both of you. So this comes from Adam Sternberg's Twitter feed, and I think he also wrote a New York Magazine piece online about this or related to this. SCOTUS fun fact, of the 9 current justices, and that includes Kennedy, 6 are oldest or only children. 3 are middle children. That's Kagan, Kennedy, and Roberts. There are no youngest children. Scalia was an only child, as is Gorsuch, as is Kavanaugh. And Adam also informs us that since 1915, the SCOTUS justices who were oldest or only children have shown strong conservative tendencies and generally upheld established ideas. It is middle children and youngest children who showed liberal tendencies and vote more reliably to change laws. So as younger children, you can enjoy the more rebellious Supreme Court connections.
I'm the younger of two, but I'm a younger who acts like an older. You're an oldest and you act like an oldest.
I'm an oldest through and through. Yeah. It's so depressing. It's like the thing I like the least about myself. John, you can carry this mantle.
I'm a disappointment to everyone. did you know? Here's the thing that I would take note of. I mean, we all know about the Harvard and Yale and all the damn Ivy Leagues, but don't we? Isn't it possible, David Plotz, as a member of the St. Almond's community, that there will be two people from Georgetown Prep on the Supreme Court?
Not just two people from Georgetown Prep. They were one class apart.
Yeah.
What I was wondering, Emily. Did all the conservative justices go to single sex? So I'm sure Roberts,
oh my God,
Kavanaugh, Gorsuch all went to single sex boys schools, religious schools. I think Alito did, but and Thomas is the only one I'm unsure of. Thomas certainly had a Catholic education, but I don't know whether it was a single sex school.
I bet not.
Okay, my chatter. So first, I'm going to do listener chatter. So as you know, we've been collecting listener recommendations for chatter, your wonderful things that you've read, interesting things you've seen that you think would be worth sharing. So I want to do one from Zach Hamed, who's at ZMH. And his note was, feels like something John or David would chatter about. And indeed it is. So he sent along a Gizmodo link, and it's to a story which is about the San Francisco Fire Department's ladder making. And it's fascinating and a beautiful essay about a photo essay about how the San Francisco Fire Department still makes its own ladders, and it makes them out of wood, which you'd think would be crazy. Why wood burns? So why would you have fire ladders made out of wood? But they're wood lasts forever. And so if it doesn't burn, unlike aluminum, which you use it for a while, it bends, it gets cracks. Wood can go through you know, any number of lifts and as long as it doesn't, as long as it doesn't fully burn to a crisp, it can be sanded down and reused. And so they have these ladders that are, you know, decades and decades old, 70 years old, which are beautiful, and because they've been varnished over and over again. And then they're still making new ones out of these wonderful, wonderful, very dense fir trees that they can still harvest in Northern California. So look at this Gizmodo story about San Francisco Fire Department ladders. It's great. And then my chatter is actually a wonderful Twitter thread that Anton Troynikoff, who's at a Troyn, T-R-O-Y-N, had this week, which is things that happen in Silicon Valley and also in the old Soviet Union. And it's just a list of just very funny kind of aperçus. So waiting years to receive a car you ordered to find that's of poor workmanship and qualities. Promises of colonizing the solar system while you toil in drudgery day in and day out. Living five adults to a two-room apartment. Being told you are constructing utopia while the system crumbles around you. Totally not illegal taxis by private citizens moonlighting to make ends meet. Productivity largely falsified to satisfy appearance of sponsoring elites. Elite power struggles result in massive collateral damage, sometimes purges. Failures are bizarrely upheld as triumphs. Anyway, I found it extremely funny, and I would recommend you take a look at the whole thing. You guys, the lack of any laughter suggests maybe it's a limited audience. But there are a lot of other people who retweeted it, so definitely there's a market for it. That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Izzy Rode. You can follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest, and please send us your cocktail chatters, like movies that you've seen, books that you've read, great articles that you've read, like the San Francisco Fire Department. That was a wonderful one. Tweeted us with your ideas for cocktail chatter for next week. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thank you for listening. And remember, we have a show next week at the Keswick Theater, Glenside, PA, just outside of Philly, on Wednesday, July 18th. Slate.com/live to get tickets. See you there.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.